They are no more precious than the deserts of Iran and the Bedouins of Yemen's heritage. No more precious than the mountains of Java, the seas off the coast of the Philippines, the steppes of Asia, the savannas of Africa, the forests of North America, the ice caps of the Arctic, or hundreds of other threatened places. Every one of these represents a battle line, and every one of them forces us to search the depths of our individual and collective souls. I was reminded of a statistic that sums it all up. The income ratio of the one-fifth of the world's population in the wealthiest countries to the one-fifth in the poorest countries went from 30-1 in 1960 to 74-1 in 1995. And the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the IMF, and the rest of the banks, corporations, and governments involved in international aid continue to tell us that they are doing their jobs, that progress has been made. So, here I was in Ecuador again, in the country that was just one of many battle lines, but that holds a special place in my heart. It was 2003, 35 years after I had first arrived, as a member of a U.S. organization that bears the word peace in its name. This time, I had come in order to try to prevent a war that for three decades I had helped to provoke. It would seem that events in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Venezuela might be enough to deter us from another conflict. Yet, in Ecuador, the situation was very different. This war would not require the U.S. Army, for it would be fought by a few thousand indigenous warriors equipped only with spears, machetes, and single-shot muzzle-loaded rifles. They would face off against a modern Ecuadorian army, a handful of U.S. Special Forces advisors, and jackal-trained mercenaries hired by the oil companies. This would be a war, like the 1995 conflict between Ecuador and Peru, that most people in the United States would never hear about. And recent events had escalated the probability of such a war. In December 2002, oil company representatives accused an indigenous community of taking a team of its workers hostage. They suggested that the warriors involved were members of a terrorist group with implications of possible ties to Al-Qaeda. It was an issue made especially complicated because the oil company had not received government permission to begin drilling. However, the company claimed its workers had the right to perform preliminary, non-drilling investigations, a claim vehemently disputed by the indigenous groups a few days later when they shared their side of the story. The oil workers, tribal representatives insisted, had trespassed on lands where they were not allowed. The warriors had carried no weapons, nor had they threatened the oil workers with violence of any sort. In fact, they had escorted the workers to their village, where they offered them food and chicha, a local beer. While their visitors feasted, the warriors persuaded the workers' guides to paddle away. However, the tribe claimed, the workers were never held against their will. They were free to go wherever they pleased. Driving down that road, I remembered what the Shuars had told me in 1990 when, after selling IPS,